Yeah.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 10th, 2015. The first item on the agenda is informational overview of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Ms. Britton, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Olson, Williamson, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. I am Juliet Britton, the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Review Board. I've been asked to give a 10-minute overview of what our board does, what we do in terms of our everyday operations, and my understanding is that you'll be possibly having a work session on a couple bills that affect our operations. We have some low-tech slides that I think everyone has. So there's four primary functions of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. The primary and original purpose of our creation in the late 1970s was to provide a multidisciplinary board who could supervise and monitor those who successfully assert the insanity defense. So prior to the 1970s, individuals were taken to court on any myriad of charges and crimes, and then they were found guilty except for insanity, and there was no body really to supervise and monitor to ensure public safety once that court adjudication happened. So our board was created to monitor our clients who reside at the state hospital, and then once they're out in the community on conditional release, continue to provide that supervision and monitoring. In 2005, this legislature created a insanity defense for juveniles, so we were again given that responsibility to supervise the youth who successfully assert the insanity defense. And in our state, that's called Responsible Except for Insanity, REI. In the late 2009 session, we were given yet again an additional duty to be the relief authority for those in the state of Oregon who have any sort of mental health adjudication. So that could be somebody who's been civilly committed, that could be somebody who has a court-mandated guardian to act on their behalf. Anyone with a mental health determination who is barred under federal or state law from having a firearms can now come to our board to request restoration of those rights. So that was our gun relief program. Part of that program was also an attempt by the state to consolidate all of the mental health records in the state. Oregon Health Authority, PSRB, and the courts, and to reconcile those names of those who are barred and to upload those names into the NICS system. That's the firearm prohibited database that the FBI maintains. So with cooperation with the Oregon Health Authority, State Police, PSRB, and the courts, we've successfully uploaded all of the Oregonians who are currently barred from owning a firearm, and their names are now in the NICS database.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How many have made a request for reestablishment?
Representative Kreigler, since 2009, we implemented the program and started holding hearings in 2010, and we've had three individuals. Three individuals requested, and all three were granted their firearms privileges.
Okay, thank you.
At the last legislative session, the board was given two additional tasks. They expanded the civil commitment law to create a new type of civil commitment. We call it the Senate Bill 421. And we were given the responsibility to supervise and monitor those individuals that meet a very narrow civil commitment criteria, who are considered to be extremely dangerous and that are in need of supervision and monitoring. So we have taken on those additional duties. To this date, we only have two clients that have been placed under this particular type of civil commitment. And finally, we're one of the various public safety agencies who are implementing the new sex offender designation law that passed at the last session, in which we're going to do risk assessments on our sex offenders and designate them accordingly. So that's kind of the big picture, the four different program areas that we cover. Historically, our board was created to have a public safety mandate. Prior to our creation, it was the Oregon State Hospital who was determining when individuals could leave the state hospital. The state hospital has a recovery focus. They're in the business of providing clinical services, not necessarily making risk assessments and judgments. So it was thought that having a board with public safety as the mandate was more appropriate. Next slide. We have 10 board members. We have a 5-member juvenile panel and a 5-member adult panel. Each panel has a psychiatrist, psychologist, attorney, probation officer, and a member of the public. We are considered a part-time board, so we have hearings weekly. And so most of our board members have full-time employment and are doing this for $334 each day they sit on a hearing. We conducted over 700 hearings last year, and our budget is $2.4 million with 11 FTE. Primarily, our staff is focused on our hearings process. That is how our board, that's the bread and butter of what we do. That's how we get individuals found appropriate for conditional release and also do the supervision and monitoring of those already out in the community. Next slide, it gives you a little snapshot of our demographics. As you can imagine, most of our clients are, it reflects the general population, 80% Caucasian, mostly male clients. What we've seen in the last 10 years is, thanks to the legislature funding community residential and mental health treatment programs, is we've seen the number of clients in the hospital slowly go down, and we have most of our clients out in the community. So the census, for example, right now, the census for GEI is the lowest it's been in at least over 10 years. So, and that's a direct result of funding the community mental health services that you're asked to do at every session. We have 4% veterans, and a very small portion of our clients are intellectually or what we commonly refer to as developmentally disabled. The next slide gives you a snapshot of where are our clients coming from. So what counties are, and it's by a geographic map, which I think is helpful to see. So these are our current clients. This is where they are coming to us from. As you can imagine, the Tri-County area gives us some of the higher number of clients, but also Lane County and Umatilla County, and then our southern region, Jackson County, is one of the more popular locales. The next slide shows you where are we actually placing the clients. Once they're under our jurisdiction and they're ready to return to the community from the state hospital, where are our programs that are effectively providing treatment to our clients? And again, that's primarily in the Tri-County area. There really has been an effort, particularly in the last 2 to 3 bienniums, to have a geographic representation. And so as you can see, some of the development has been out east in Umatilla County and Curry County as well, is one of our recent developments.
Why, if I could ask, why is Umatilla so high?
Representative Barker, they have providers that are interested in serving the PSRB population. At the time, I think, of some of this development, there was an Eastern Oregon hospital out there. So they, you know, they were familiar with these sort of treatment programs, so there was a willingness and ability to do that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The next slide gives you a little snapshot of our juvenile clients, far less juvenile clients than we have under the adult panel. We only have 15 currently. What's interesting about our juvenile population is the percentage of those that are developmentally disabled, 40% compared to the much smaller 8% for our adults. So in our juvenile world, we have a lot more individuals that fall into the DD services, so the Department of Human Services, instead of addictions and mental health. Also, the diagnoses for some of our youth they're a little different, primarily mood disorders. Okay, the next slide. So we often get asked the question, where do our clients live? As you saw from the earlier slide, most are living
at... I just can't help but commenting and asking the question. It seems to me, compared to the prison population, the minority populations are much lighter. Is the sense that this is a difference in sentencing issues or something about the pathology distribution in the population? I mean, it seems very striking.
Representative Greenleck, that's a great question. I can only speculate. That might be a defense counsel question, too, to ask, you know, why is it this demographic that's asserting the insanity defense? You know, it's hard to say. I think that, you know, there are certain views on mental health. There's stigma attached, cultural barriers that maybe would prevent someone from not wanting to enter that system, and there would be a preference to go to Department of Corrections instead. So it's always the defendant's choice to plead guilty except for insanity. So ultimately, it's up to the defendant to choose what's best for them.
Well, it's also up to the prosecutor and to the defense attorney as well.
So typically, the amount of time you're placed under our supervision is the maximum sentence you would have received had you pled guilty. So the statute currently reads up to the maximum. Most of our guilty except for insanity are stipulated between the defense counsel and the prosecutor, and so we're seeing most of our clients are placed under our jurisdiction for the maximum time. So at a minimum, that's going to be 5 years if it's a Class C felony, 10 years, 20 years, or life, depending on the crime. So that's certainly another factor in considering whether or not someone wants to assert the insanity defense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So our clients primarily are living in the community right now, almost 70% of our clients. And I wanted to briefly talk about the five-layer review before the board authorizes someone to be released from the state hospital and re-enter the community. First, there's the hospital treatment team that recognizes that the client is at a point in their treatment where they can be adequately treated and controlled in the community. That's followed by a risk review board. That's an internal board at the state hospital, primarily clinicians who also authorize conditional release planning for that patient. Then they submit a evaluation to the board, and the board orders the community to weigh in on this. And the community, and I give some examples. So in Multnomah County, for example, Cascadia, Luke Dorf, Columbia Care are some of our community providers. They interview our clients. They review all of the voluminous treatment records and decide if conditional release is appropriate and whether or not they have the program where they feel they can safely provide treatment to the individual. And then we have a full hearing that includes the community doctor that's going to be receiving this patient, as well as the Oregon State Hospital doctor and members of the treatment team. And we have a full hearing where we specifically talk about this client's clinical needs, risk factors, so we can make sure that there's a good handoff between the state hospital and the community provider. We will never conditional release an individual into the community unless the county mental health agency says, yes, we think we can supervise this client safely. So we're never going to force a client onto a county mental health agency. Once the client's out on conditional release, the next slide really sort of highlights, at least initially, what is the day in the life of a PSRB client. Most of our clients are going to be living at a licensed residential program. Usually that's 5 beds, 8 beds. And they're going to be probably going off-site to a day treatment clinic where they might attend groups, go to AA meetings, see their psychiatrist, meet with their case manager. Lots of everyday living skill training going on, learning how to ride the bus, managing money, things of that nature. Eventually, our clients then, as they gain those skills, can move through the continuum of residential care, so maybe move to semi-independent, maybe get some supported employment, maybe go back to school. We have several clients that are able to attend the various universities that are in the state. And eventually, the goal of all of the county mental health programs is to reintegrate clients back into the community with an eye towards independent living. I mean, that's ultimately the goal. The next slide really highlights how our board does our supervision and monitoring. We have a LEDS entry for all of our clients. If there's any police contact, we'll know about it immediately through our LEDS terminal. We also have an after-hours office number that law enforcement, rarely, frankly, does that happen because our clients are very stable. We also provide technical assistance to our community providers who are actually providing the direct therapeutic services to our clients, as well as random UAs are a very common condition that the board requires. Some clients require a high level of supervision in the community, so we might mandate that they have to be supervised anytime they're outside the community. And then, of course, monthly progress reports are provided for every single one of our clients. The next slide gives you the breakdown as to where do our clients live, which level of care. We call this the continuum of care. The secure residential treatment facility would be the most secure with locked doors. The least secure, if you will, would of course be independent living. And at any given time, our clients are moving down or up this continuum of care, depending on their psychiatric stability. You know, we hope that all of our clients are moving down the continuum, but sometimes, you know, a client might need a two-week respite at a licensed residential, and that's enough to stabilize them, and then they can return to their home. For our clients that are developmentally disabled, they would be living in the DHS housing and receive services through them, and then Addictions and Mental Health provides the, and the county mental health provide the services for our clients with mental health or psychiatric conditions. So this this extensive network of community providers that this body has, frankly, funded through the bienniums really allows us to keep most of our clients in the community any given month. 99% of our clients are kept on conditional release every month, which I think everyone would agree is in the best interest of public safety, as well as clinically for a client who can stay in their community even when they might need extra services and support. Finally, I wanted to end with our recidivism rate. The board has an outstanding recidivism rate. We have very few clients commit new offenses, and when they do, in general, most of them are nonviolent. The one incident from 2014, for example, was somebody left the state, so it was an escape too. And really, this is a direct correlation between the funding of community mental health services, who really do have programs who can adequately monitor our clients on conditional release. And this has been our recidivism rate for almost the board's entirety of 30 years. With that, are there any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question that you may not know the answer to, because it's in fact before they're under your jurisdiction. I assume that the vast majority of people who assert the insanity offense and successfully and ultimately end up under PSRB jurisdiction, that is agreed to, i.e., that is not a contested defense that the prosecution and the defense stipulate to that, and the judge signs off on that. How often does it? I assume sometimes that is, in fact, a contested defense that ultimately goes to a jury or a judge. But I actually don't recall hearing about that ever happening in Oregon courts that I've heard of.
Representative Barton, members of the committee, 99% of our GEIs are stipulated. So it would just be a handful every year. For example, I know that there were three this year in Multnomah County, I think, just as an example.
Okay.
Most often when they are contested, it's going to be before a judge only, not a jury. So a jury GEI trial is very unusual.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the beginning of your presentation, because it took me a while to do a little math, and forgive me, I'm a ways and means person. I'm not going to have a ways and means conversation here, but I have learned that the dollars explain a lot about how a agency or an organization operates and what programs they provide. And so a couple quick things here. I noticed, so you have your stipend and 700 hearings, and I kind of did some rough math there. So there's a bulk of your budget with the 11 FTE that's left for something else. So I'm assuming that those are programs, those are different pieces that go on. Can you tell me what some of those would be?
Representative Springer, members of the committee, most of our budget is personnel to support the board in its mission of conducting hearings. So our budget does not cover the actual services that are provided to the clients. So the funding of the services really are going to come from through the support of AMH or the county mental health. So we're not providing the actual clinical services and do not fund those services. So this is primarily, it's personnel. An agency of 11 FTE and that funds its service and supply and personnel for the most part.
Okay. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Once again, appreciate it. We'll close the information meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 2433.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2433 comes to this committee from the governor at the request of the Oregon State Police. It modifies existing requirements for electronic citations. The bill would permit the use of electronic citations in a different size and format than currently permitted. There is no revenue impact, minimal fiscal, and the bill is ready to move.
Captain Anderson, please.
I understand the issue on 2556, though.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Anderson, and I am a captain with the Oregon State Police Patrol Division. And I'm here today testifying in support of House Bill 2433. The intent of this bill is to remedy a minor formatting issue with citations, both violation and criminal, that are filed electronically with the court system. A little history on electronic filing. It was back in 1995 when the legislature first passed legislation that allowed for the electronic filing of violation citations with the court. This became ORS 153770. And then in 2005, the legislature again passed legislation allowing the electronic filing of criminal citations. And this became ORS 133073. Those are the two statutes that are before you today in this bill. As of today, there are at least 37 police agencies statewide that are electronically filing their citations with the courts. Every circuit court in this state is set up to receive electronic citations and is receiving electronic citations. And there are 28 justice courts within this state that are also accepting citations electronically. The issue before us today is really the format and size of the electronic citation. Format, size, and information requirements for uniform citations are set through Supreme Court order and then adopted pursuant to statute. And both of the statutes within this bill clearly state that a uniform citation shall contain all of the information required in a Supreme Court order, and they do. But neither statute provides an exception for electronically filed citations to be of a different size or a format than a traditional handwritten citation. For example, the Supreme Court order says that uniform citations will be 5 inches wide and 8 inches long. Well, an electronically filed citation is 4 inches wide and 22 inches long. So, in one county in this state, a defense attorney has made an issue of this and won on a couple of occasions. So the purpose of this bill is to remedy that and allow law enforcement agencies, circuit courts, and justice courts to continue realizing the efficiencies that come along with electronic filing of citations. And that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
If you have any questions.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem right, Mr. Chair, not being able to take time out to write a ticket and send it in anymore.
I mean, in the rain.
Exactly.
And another benefit of this is the fact that that goes right to the court, so there's no time for somebody to play games with it. I mean, we had somebody actually engaging in criminal activity by holding out tickets and things, and we got rid of it pretty quick, but not quick enough. So I think this is a good idea. Anything else? Okay, we'll close. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2433.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2433 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2433 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Williamson will be the carrier.
Be glad to.
Okay, open a public hearing on House Bill 2562.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2562 comes to this committee from Representative Greenlick. The bill amends Oregon law to permit the expungement of GEI adjudications if the offense would be expungible as a criminal conviction. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, and before we start that, I also want to announce, I'm sorry I neglected to do this. House Bill 2556 is not on, and we pulled that off the agenda for today. We'll hear that at a later time. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. With your permission, I'd like to make a brief comment on 2556 before we go on. Essentially, that has some issues with it. We've found a work group that's working on a similar issue, actually the aid and assist issue, and we think we've got them agree to perfect the bill, and we hope you'll get 2556 back in a different version. Thank you. I'm here to open a public hearing on House Bill 2562. We have a technical issue with this bill as well, although I'd like to have the hearing and discuss the issue in it. It turns out when we asked for a change in 2562, the Legislative Council realized that the bill in its existing form is a violation of its own referring to clause. So we have a bill safely tucked over in the Healthcare Committee that will amend to deal with the issues we're talking about today and kick back to this committee without recommendation, and we'll actually have a bill to work on. Basically, the issue is a simple one. If a person is convicted of a crime, somewhere downstream, they have the possibility of going to the courts and asking that arrest and that conviction be expunged. It turns out if somebody is found guilty except for insanity and is committed to the hospital and to PSRB, gets out, gets well, lives his life, there is no way statutorily for that person to come back and ask for expungement of that arrest record. That's causing a lot of problems for some people downstream. They have trouble getting a job. And all this will do in its final form will take people that have been convicted except for insanity or found responsible except for insanity. And under certain conditions, downstream, after they've been released from the program and are living their life, will have an opportunity to come to the courts and ask for that arrest record to be expunged. And that's basically all it does. So I think there's some people who want to talk about it. I said, if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to do that.
And you have another bill coming, though, that to replace this.
There will be a bill coming over from the Health Care Committee to replace it. We've asked for it to be amended. It has the right relating to clause, and we'll give up that bill and turn it into this one and send it over here as soon as possible.
Okay, the one thing that just pops into my head about this is we just had the information before about somebody regaining their firearms rights to own a firearm. If there's an expungement, I would assume that would do that. I don't know how that is communicated to the NICS, whatever, the federal firearms thing. So that's just something else to think about in there.
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Okay, thank you. Call Alex Bassos and Bob Jundep, please. You go in either order, just be sure to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Alex Bassos. I'm the Director of Training and Outreach for the Metropolitan Public Defender in Portland, Oregon. I specialize in expungements and mental health. I've been running an expungement clinic for about a decade now, about 14,000 expungements that we've handled, or expungement cases anyway. I wrote a book on mental health and criminal defense. I teach a class at the law school on this subject. Anyway, expungements and mental health, this is the intersection that we're talking about. The purpose of the set-aside statute, we don't actually have an expungement statute, we have a set-aside statute. That is, it seals records. It doesn't make them go away completely. The purpose of that set-aside statute is to decrease the stigma, to wipe away some of the stigma of a crime being on a person's record, assuming a whole lot of things are true. So you have to have completed the sentence of the court. You have to have been crime-free for a number of years, quite a long time if you have two things on your record, a decade. Your behavior and circumstances have to warrant it. It has to be the right type of crime, that is, lots of crimes are simply never going to be eligible. And if you meet all those conditions, then in that case, we will seal that record and decrease the stigma. Now, in the modern day of the internet, it still doesn't make it go away, but it is a positive thing for folks who have truly turned around their life. The purpose of having the insanity defense be an adjudication rather than a conviction is supposed to be for it to be less stigmatizing, not more stigmatizing. The name guilty except insane is fairly stigmatizing in and of itself. But the fact that it is not expungible ever means by law that a person has this thing on their record for the rest of their life. And it gets reported on a criminal record exactly like a conviction. And I have advised many clients that they should not go forward with the insanity defense, with GEI, for that reason, because it is far more stigmatizing than a conviction would be. That just doesn't make sense, right? If the point of it is supposed to be that it is less stigmatizing, why would we have this law put together that makes it more stigmatizing? And in the end, it doesn't seem to me that there is any basis for that additional stigma other than the existence of the mental illness. Really, all the insanity defense is that all the elements of the crime have been met. And in addition, this person had a mental illness at the time of the crime that was so extreme that they substantially lack the capacity to understand that their behavior was criminal or to control it. That is, the mental illness was what was driving what was going on. So imagine someone early on that had a psychotic break and it just wasn't under control on medications, and they end up getting in a fight or doing something. That person, if they assert the insanity defense, if they go that route, that's going to be on their record for the rest of their life. So it it seems to me, and I'm urging this committee to move forward, obviously, that those two things are simply not aligned in our law, that our purposes of these two things are not aligned, and they should be. There are a couple fixes that are fairly easy that I would add to the bill. One of them is, it seems to me fairly important that for the purposes of the expungement statute, that the person have completed the sentence of the court. That's one of the requirements. So just because the timelines have been met, you don't get to cut off your probation halfway through before the probation department has said you've completed your probation. And the same thing here. If the person is still being supervised by the Psychiatric Security Review Board, it doesn't make a ton of sense that you'd be able to get an expungement and cut that off. But, you know, those are fairly small fixes. And it seems to me that it's fairly easy to make those happen and go forward with a fairly successful integration of GEI and expungement. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I'm going to blame Representative Barton for this because he told me there were no dumb questions.
That's not what I said, Representative. I'm just kidding.
I typed this so that I would say it right, and you kind of touched on it for a minute, but I'm still, because I'm really into electronic media and it is just something that's part of my life. So how do you truly expunge somebody these days? Because, you know, Joe is in this situation. This passes, he's expunged, but we wrote about him on Facebook 9 years ago, and it's always out there. It's there forever. So how do you truly, I'm just for my own information, how do you truly expunge somebody?
Chair Barker, Representative Post, succinctly, you can't. We are living in a post-internet world and with an expungement statute that is pre-internet.
Yeah.
And, you know, Facebook is a problem, but so are the websites that post people's mugshots and media writing about the person. And moreover, there's a problem with databases that aren't located in Oregon being able to regulate those so that when something is taken off a person's record, they follow, because many of them don't. And this state doesn't have the ability to regulate them because of both our free speech clause and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. It's difficult. However, that's not to say that the expungement statute, our set-aside statute really more accurately, doesn't have some real positive effects on people's lives. I see it every single week when we do these expungements for folks and they come back and they're able to get a job or housing where they weren't before. So you can no longer make anything completely go away. And some people, if it made the media, are really going to be stigmatized significantly forever. But that doesn't mean that the expungement statute doesn't do some real significant good.
Okay, so just small follow-up. Thank you. Okay. So you said you have some examples of where they've been able to regain a job or get a new job. Okay, so have you seen – I don't know why I'm just caught up on this. This is really – this almost feels symbolic because I'm just, again, I'm so wrapped up in the electronic world myself. It's been my life. I'm afraid this is almost symbolic. Can you give me a real, I know you can't name a name or anything like that, but a tangible example of perhaps where it wouldn't have mattered with the electronic media. Does that make sense?
There are plenty of people who don't make it onto one of those mugshot websites and who weren't written about on Facebook and whose case didn't make the media, who haven't really left that many traces on the internet. I would say most people are actually in that position. So I mean, it's not that the concern isn't legitimate and significant, but there is something significant to be said for the expungement statute as well, partly because lots of people aren't in the situation you're hypothesizing, but also because that symbolism isn't nothing. Even if it were just symbolism, it is a legal piece of paper from the court saying that this has been set aside in the interest of justice. A piece of paper that you can show to employers, that you can show to renters, and say, look, this thing was here, but it is not anymore, and you are allowed under the statute to say that this thing doesn't exist. And I'm coming to you, employer or renter, and in the utmost of honesty, and showing you what fully went on. And that does some real good. That's not nothing.
Okay. Well, thank you for your patience.
Of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Alex, you and I spent a little bit of time over the last few years trying to do something with cleaning up that statute with a few DAs, and didn't get anywhere with it. But that was a good exercise, I reckon. But one of the things that we were working on is we specifically identified certain crimes that we could get there with, and then, you know, others that we couldn't get. I mean, the DAs couldn't get there with. I thought we were close. This bill captures everything. Have you given any thought about where Representative Greenlick's wanting to go with this on the potential of going back to what the original crime would have been for the client and considering that under expungement?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I thought actually that's what this bill did, that based on the original crime. So if it's an A or B felony, or if it's a traffic crime, or if it's one of the excluded crimes originally, that it would not now be eligible. That was my assumption. I think that's pretty necessary to make this workable, frankly.
Oh, I missed that.
You wouldn't want an adjudication for rape one, for example, to be eligible if it's not eligible as a crime. So I'm not advocating that anything more be done for GEI adjudications than is done for convictions. This was never on the table in the expungement bill that we were trying to work on, and I think there is going to be such a bill this session. That's a kind of limited bill that's an agreement between the district attorneys and the defense, and hopefully there's something workable. But
my understanding, we just want to make this comparable to some of the victims for the crime, same crimes. Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. As parallel as possible, including, that's why I mentioned completing the sentence of the court, that the parallel would be completing the supervision of the PSRB. Everything should be paralleling.
Yes, sir. I'd also like to comment that this doesn't automatically grant expungement. It just gives a vehicle for a request for expungement. And if you need another bill, you can have this one with its relating to clause.
This one's up for grabs. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedeff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. As we've talked about before, Disability Rights Oregon works on behalf of the people who end up in the state hospital through various routes, including under the PSRB. And so we've had outreach workers at the state hospital since 1986. Becoming part of the lives of the people who are there, hearing their stories and getting to know what it's like and what their challenges are. And so while Mr. Bassos has the opportunity to see people before they end up getting adjudicated and sent to the hospital, we work with people who have had that experience. And as you, if you can place yourself in the situation of a person who finds themselves in the state hospital under those conditions, they are involved in a tragedy, usually a double tragedy that involves their being overtaken, if you will, by a mental illness and a psychosis so bad that they're unable to control their behavior, and their behavior results in criminal activity, which may have harmed someone else or property and so forth. And so here they are at the state hospital, and they understand that they are facing perhaps a very long period of time in order to engage in mental health treatment with the hopes of recovery and being able to return to the community and return to their lives and be a functioning and productive member of society. And I can tell you that the entire hospital is geared toward that goal for every patient who comes in the door. This is a psychiatric facility. It is not a jail. It is truly designed to work with that patient on their recovery. And so if you're a patient, a part of your process is to get to know the rules there and get to know what's being asked of you by the professionals in order to get better. And getting better is not only taking medications and controlling certain types of symptoms, but it's also learning how to live in the world again so that you're ready to do that. And so everything is geared, and the PSRB is geared as well in terms of their job in helping people step down out of the hospital to have people reengage in society and be as productive and successful as possible. And that's what you may hear is called the recovery model, that people can recover and they need, and the view is that everyone can, and everyone needs to have that hope and that desire to recover. But imagine if at the end of that long journey, and for many people it is quite a long journey, that you now, for reasons that are outside of your control, you cannot get a place to live, you cannot get a job, and you have other types of discrimination against you because of your past, a past that you've worked as hard as you can to overcome and to recover, dealing with the difficulties that a chronic mental illness can impose upon you and your family. Expungement aids in that process because it gives people additional hope that they can work through, be successful, follow the rules, be successful in the community, and then be able to return to life. And that is what we should all be aiming for, and our state policy should as well, and that's why we support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you both. Okay, since we have another bill to replace this would come in, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2562. Any further business to come before the committee? We stand adjourned. Thank you, committee. Before the committee, we stand adjourned. Thank you, committee. Any further business to come